On a Wednesday, it is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Summer is prime time to watch the massive ships go by on the Great Lakes. Now, back in late April, our show broadcast from Superior right around the time when the ice was breaking up in the Duluth Superior Harbor and maritime shipping season was just getting underway. And this is when you'll see those 1,000-foot freighters carrying their first cargo load of iron ore, coal, maybe grain. We toured a shipyard in Superior to take a closer look at what exactly goes on to ready these vessels for the water and what could compromise their operations. Here's producer Laura Pavin.
It's a crisp afternoon at Fraser Shipyards in Superior. James Farkas is president and CEO. He puts on a yellow construction hat and slides on a pair of clear safety glasses.
Just take a walk.
He rounds the corner, and there, towering 100 feet above the ground, is the Tim S. Duell. It's a freighting vessel that stretches the length of 2 football fields along the dock. It's named after a former president of the company that owns it, which means the stakes were high.
And I'm being facetious here, but Mrs. Duell grabbed me around her throat and said, "Don't let that vessel leave without it getting painted." And as you can see, it's painted.
It's a lacquered deep blue, with its name in bright white letters. Crew members wearing green construction hats mill around the vessel. They're doing maintenance in a dry dock before it hits the water. A pulley system of ropes and chains hangs around the boat's massive propeller. They're working on the propulsion system, and they're making sure that the Duell is structurally sound. Fraser Shipyards does a lot of maintenance. Building new ships, not so much.
Very, very infrequently do they build new vessels.
That's because the lifespan of ships that sail the Great Lakes is long, between 50 and 100 years. To get to the top of the ship, Farkas climbs a yellow metal ladder. It runs from the edge of the land, up across the dry dock far below, to the vessel's deck. The top is flat, and just feet away is a steep drop-off into a huge cavernous opening. At some point, the entire space will be full of material. What it's filled with, though, is still a question. Depends on market demands.
You know, we see taconite being pretty constant. Coal will continue to decline, in my humble opinion.
Taconite's where it's at.
Well, I guess so.
Taconite is low-grade iron ore that's melted down into steel. It's just one of the materials that travels through the Great Lakes ports each year. Below in the dry dock, materials are strewn about. Ropes, barrels, plastic tarps, and scrap metal. In the next couple days, crews will clean out the area and fill the dry dock with water. The ship will need a day or two to stabilize. After that, the vessel will float away. It takes dozens of people to ready the Tim S. Duell for its next journey. Farkas argues that maintenance work at the shipyard is strong because of the Jones Act.
It's a benefit to the families and people who work here and others around.
But Farkas has his eye on the Jones Act.
Well, there's some effort to roll it back.
And that was producer Laura Pavin in Superior. The Jones Act there, it is a federal law dating back almost a century. The law requires that all cargo carried between U.S. ports be transported on vessels that are built, owned, and operated by U.S. citizens. And the maritime industry is big business across the Great Lakes states. It generates billions in economic activity. Earlier this year, a Utah senator introduced a bill that would repeal the Jones Act. Do you work at a shipyard or in maritime shipping? How has the Jones Act affected your work? We're at 800-642-1234. Richard Stewart teaches transportation and logistics management and is director of the Transportation and Logistics Research Center at UW-Superior. He's a former sea captain, and he joins us from our Superior studios this morning. Richard, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Laura. Delight to be here.
So why should the Jones Act matter to people who aren't shipbuilders or working in shipyards?
Well, let's give a little historical perspective. The Jones Act was not the first cabotage law, Passenger Vessel Services Act, and we've actually had cabotage laws since the beginning of our Constitution. Cabotage is a French word in origin, and it means between the capes. And the idea is that transportation that occurs within domestic areas be controlled, regulated for safety, economic, and security reasons. Every mode of transportation in the United States has some form of cabotage law.
The Jones Act really has stood the test of time. For what purpose was it drawn up and passed in the first place, and how has it continued over almost a century?
When World War I started, America did not have a cabotage law for freight. Many of the ships that traded between Miami and New York, places like that, were owned by foreign companies. They immediately went to the war effort for the other foreign countries. Freight rates rose by 500% to transport cargo. The United States was unprepared. We didn't have shipyards. We didn't have skilled labor. When James Farkas talked about repairing or building ships, to create a naval architect or a shipwright takes years and years. You don't hire somebody off the street to build a ship. So we didn't have those resources. The U.S. government spent, by today's terms, billions of dollars to try and build a fleet of ships to supply for the war effort. And they resolved in 1920, when the Jones Act was passed, that they'll never be caught unprepared again. And when World War II came around, we were prepared, and places like Superior and Duluth turned out hundreds of ships in short order to serve the need of the merchant marine.
So what kind of impact today does the Jones Act have on these shipyards along the Great Lakes? What do you see?
Well, the Jones Act means that ships that operate in the domestic U.S. trade be built in the United States, crewed by American citizens, and managed by an American company. And that means we keep not only the ships here, but we keep the businesses headquartered in this area. So the Great Lakes fleets out of Duluth, we have other ones, American Steamship out of Buffalo. So it not only produces the ships, but the management skills in the area too. If we didn't have a Jones Act, some of our ships could be built overseas and brought here, and we would lose that shipbuilding expertise. The ships could be managed and operated by a foreign country with foreign personnel operating on them, and we would gain no tax revenue. We'd gain no management expertise. If you could imagine, and the airline industry has similar cabotage laws, if you could, the people want to overturn the Jones Act, say, well, it's much cheaper if I use a foreign ship built in Panama, crewed by Russians and operated out of Cyprus, and indeed it probably would to run between Chicago and Duluth. You could do the same thing with an airplane too, by the way. All modes of transportation limit for national security and defense and economic reasons. Who can operate within the borders of the United States?
Talking about the Jones Act and the impact it has on Great Lakes shipping with Richard Stewart. He is director of the Transportation and Logistics Research Center at UW-Superior. Richard, what you just said there, the think tank, the Cato Institute, looks at the Jones Act as the reason why shipping costs are so high and why our shipbuilding industry is so diminished. What would you say to that?
Well, they're two separate items. Turning around, and if let's assume we repealed the Jones Act, that does not mean we would suddenly have an influx of new shipbuilding and ship repair taking place. That wouldn't occur because that would move overseas and be done overseas. The Cato Institute, a number of other organizations over the years, as well as elected officials, have suggested that we do away with the Jones Act. Laws have come forward. The U.S. Navy has been opposed to it because they, speaking as a former naval captain, our job is to wage war at sea. It is not to carry cargo, and that's what merchant ships do. And in time of war, national emergency, we desperately need those merchant ships to carry the cargo. You can't do it on a destroyer. And so if all the ships were owned by foreign entities, we would basically have little or no control over those assets.
As we wrap up here, what do you see as the fate of the Jones Act? Where is this going?
Well, if the Cato Institute and other organizations believe that the fundamental underlying philosophy behind the Jones Act is incorrect, and you certainly could make an economic case that it's always cheaper to use the least expensive option in the marketplace, they should also be repealing the cabotage laws that prevent a Panamanian truck driver from running a truck that's owned and operated by a company overseas between Chicago and Duluth.
There are other ramifications.
Same thing with airlines. Yes.
And Richard, we have to end it there. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Richard Stewart teaches transportation and logistics management, director of the Transportation and Logistics Research Center at UW-Superior, and he joined us from our Superior studio this morning. Coming up, we talk with an expert in drone technology to look at a report that the military is testing surveillance balloons over several Midwest states, including Wisconsin. That's after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.